Hi, this is Olympia Dukakis, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Hi, everybody. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of Film Wax Radio, and you're listening to episode number 498. This is a great episode. We have a couple of really great segments coming up. We have one of the founders of the Slamdance Film Festival, which is about, by the way, to have its, this coming winter, it will have its 25th annual festival this January. It happens simultaneously to Sundance. In fact, it happens just down the block from Sundance, and it's been this way every year. It's in Park City, and it started kind of as a response to the more mainstream types of films that would play at Sundance, and they were trying to do something a lot more maverick type of a festival. And Dan Mervish is one of those founders. And Dan also has a, he's a filmmaker as well, and he has a brand new film that he collaborated with the legendary Jules Pfeiffer on, if you can believe it. And it's called Bernard and Huey, and it is currently available on various SVOD and cable platforms, I believe. It is available right now. So after you listen to me and Dan talk, you can go and seek it out, whether it's on iTunes or Amazon or wherever. And then the other segment is with the team behind a new documentary about the fashion designer and visionary, or I should say the late fashion designer visionary, Alexander McQueen. And this is a new documentary. It's opening this Friday, July 27th, and in New York and L.A., and we have on director Ian Bonhoeft and the co-director and writer of this documentary, Peter Edetge, and we're also joined by fashion journalist, author Pamela Keough, who's a longtime friend of mine. I brought her on to help me talk, kind of just co-host, if you will, the segment. She's lovely and she did a great job, and I appreciate her coming on the segment as well. But first up here, we have a short conversation with one of the programmers at Film Forum. They've been closed down for the last 3 months, and we have Mike Maggiore, who is going to tell us a little bit about the renovations, the new theater. They've added a fourth screening room, and it's reopening in just a few days on Wednesday, August 1st. And we have Mike Kahn to talk about that. I can just tell you ahead of time, since we're going to have this short conversation momentarily, there will be, because it's now they can just program so much stuff, but beginning August 1st, we have a Jacques Becker retrospective. There's the film Nico, 1988, which is sort of, a fictional version about the singer, performer Nico. And also, there is the film No Date, No Signature, and they're also showing a new 4K restoration of The Atomic Cafe. So, a lot going on at Film Forum. Let's talk to Mike Maggiore, who's called in for this short conversation, and then we'll get into the rest of the show. Mike Maggiore from Film Forum, right here on Film Wax Radio. Hello.
Hi, Adam.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, good. How are you?
Good. How are things going at Film Forum?
We're itching to reopen. I mean, it's, you know, we've been closed for almost 3 months, and
I know. Damn it.
You know, there's yes. I mean, I miss the movies and I miss the popcorn, but
not the people, not the audiences,
and of course the audiences.
yeah.
But we are getting, you know, we're getting right down to the end of the renovations. The construction of the fourth screen has been completed.
Okay.
And that is in an adjacent loading dock. So it's a new theater of about 110 seats.
Okay.
And you enter from a new corridor that's been built in the back of what was once what we call our third screen, first door on the right.
Yeah.
And we have beautiful new seats, and the seats are spaced apart a bit more than they were previously, so it's more comfortable, and we believe the sight lines have been improved.
Nice.
And we're very happy with it. All the seats are in, and there's just some technical issues that we have to sort out.
Oh, sure. I'm sure. Right. For those listening, Film Forum will be reopening after, as Mike just mentioned, 3 months renovation period on Wednesday, August 1st. Today you mentioned, I know we were texting back and forth or emailing, you were going to go into a screening. Was that in-house or was that like a test screening?
No, that was actually at a screening room in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. We can't screen anything in our theaters yet because our projectors are still being realigned and tested, and the sound, you know, the sound system is being retweaked. So everything is going to be ready for August 1, but it's not ready quite yet.
I understand. I like the idea of everybody working right up to more or less the last minute there, just kind of tweaking. And, you know, of course, there's always, there's always a sense, if there's not literally room for improvement, there's always a sense that there's always more to be done and more, you know, room for improvement when you're doing such an enormous project such as a renovation of that, like the size of what you guys have done.
And this has been done pretty quickly. I mean, by New York standards, to be closed for 3 months and build a new theater and renovate the three theaters, you know, it was definitely on a fast track, but it doesn't feel that way to us. We're missing what we do, and we really want to get back into it.
No doubt. So you broke into the next door in order to, you threw out the people, they were maybe away on vacation, and you, that
they kind were of looking thing. The other way.
Yeah, look over there.
You know, it was... It's the same building and the same landlord who owns the loading dock that is next door to Film Forum. If you ever lined up for a movie at the theater, you noticed that there was a pretty long loading dock, and we've taken about one quarter of that and turned it into, as I said, turned it into a 110 seat theater. And so it's brand new. It's a new footprint. It's about 1,300 square feet. And we really like the feel of it. It's set off from the other theaters a little bit. There's two doors to get into it. We think that, you know, it's just going to be exciting to have another screen for us to play with. You know, another screen in which we can premiere new films and repertory classics, and also hold over films that are doing well. And I know that we will use the extra screen from time to time for restored classics.
Yeah.
But
that kind of falls in between. I see. Yeah. I can see that.
And initially in the first few months, I think we're going to be premiering films with that screen. Although on the opening day, August 1, we're using it to show a revival of a classic documentary that Film Forum originally premiered in 1982 called The Atomic Cafe, which has been restored in 4K and could not be timelier. If you're not familiar with it, it's an all-archival found footage film of nuclear propaganda from the United States government in the 1940s, 50s, and early 60s. And it's funny and harrowing, horrifying, and quaint in its own way.
Yeah, there's something, kind of quaint and terrifying. Exactly right. When you see images of kids being told to duck and cover, like go under their desks, because there's an atom bomb, potentially, right? These were I was at the tail end of that, you know, as a young child in grammar school. I just, not to get too far afield, but I just recall, I think I remember that. I could be just associating those memories with Atomic Cafe, of course. Earlier viewing.
This is an educational film starring Tommy the Turtle, who instructs school children to, when they see a flash of light, meaning a nuclear explosion, that they should duck under their desk and cover their head with their hands.
Yeah, you want to avert your gaze.
Yes, or just look away for a few moments. But you know, this was what Americans were told in the 1950s, that this is how we're going to all survive a nuclear attack.
Can you imagine being afraid of Russians? I mean, what possible damage could they do? Yeah. I mean, it's just so ridiculous, this idea that Russians are to be feared, or I don't know.
It's not retro anymore, right?
What's the opposite of retro?
So that's actually a classic that we will show on the first screen.
Good.
On the same day, on August 1, we're also opening two new films.
Nico.
Nico 1988.
Okay.
About the legendary German chanteuse who was part of the Velvet Underground in the 60s and was at the end of her life, at the end of her career, was touring with a solo band. And the Danish actress Trine Dyrholm gives a pretty brilliant performance as Nico and sings all of her songs. And then the other film is No Date, No Signature, which is a new Iranian film.
Oh, great.
That both Nico and No Date, No Signature premiered at the Venice Film Festival last year.
At Venice, okay. But yeah, but it's the Atomic Cafe Restoration that is going to be playing in the new room?
Yes.
Okay, I guess I should really see if I can get into that. One of those screenings that day.
You should. Well, we're going to have the filmmakers.
Oh my
Jane
God.
Loder, Pierce Rafferty, and
I should be getting them on the show.
And Kevin Rafferty, all three of them will be
at the
theater on August 2nd and 3rd for Q&A.
Okay. I should have coordinated that with Adam and put that up. I mean, that would be great to meet with those guys.
There you go. Well, you're welcome to come. We'll be happy
to
pass you in.
What's your title at Filmform? You are programmer at
My title
large?
Is programmer. Mm-hmm. And as I said, I work on the premieres.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah.
Okay.
And I've worked here since 1994.
Really?
I started as a publicist for the premieres.
Oh, right. Okay.
And over, course of years, Karen started sharing films with me and we started discussing programming, and eventually I was given the title of co-programmer of premieres. So this is what we do together, and we've I think we balance each other out nicely in terms of our interests, and we try to show the best in world cinema that we see and that we can show, and are really engaged with what is going on in the world and new filmmakers and artists who are doing interesting work.
Very true. And the proof is in the pudding. People should check out Filmform. Go to filmform.org, correct?
Yes, thank you.
For details, for tickets, check out what's going on in the all-new Filmform. I won't say 2.0 because this place has been going through iterations over the many years that it's been around, right?
Yeah,
it's like 50-year-old institution.
Since 1970, it opened as a small space on the Upper West Side in West 88th Street in 1970 with a 16-millimeter projector and 50 folding chairs.
And a six-pack.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And eventually Karen became director in 1972 and moved the theater to Van Damme Street. And it was a single screen there in the 70s. And then it moved to Watt Street as a twin cinema in the 80s. You can actually see it, the exterior of that film forum, very briefly at the beginning of Jonathan Demme's Something Wild.
Oh, very good.
After Jeff Daniels meets Melanie Griffith at the cafe.
Mm-hmm. I'm ready to see that movie again, actually. Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I could see it again and again. It's one of my favorite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it. Wasn't that our introduction to, don't embarrass yourself, Chartoff. the bad boy in that, of course.
Ray Liotta.
What am I thinking?
Yeah.
That was my I'm sure he did done a number of films already, but that was my introduction to Ray Liotta.
I think that was the first time I saw him too. I think he was also around the same time he was in Dominic and Eugene.
Of course. That was a wonderful, I love that movie.
Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
That took in Echo Park. I remember it took place.
Right.
I have a weird memory like that. All right. Well, listen, I'm gonna let you go home.
Can I slip in one?
Absolutely. Anything you want. Absolutely.
I just want to mention that Bruce is doing a complete retrospective of the films of Jacques Becker, the French filmmaker who started as an AD to Jean Renoir, and he's that's going to be his reopening retrospective, and that's on August 1st, and it includes a restoration of Rendezvous in July, which will have its New York theatrical premiere. It was made in 1949, but it's never been shown theatrically.
And it's going to have a theatrical. Is that going to happen after the retro, or is that happening during the retro?
That's happening during. He's showing it every day during that series.
Oh, I see.
On August 1.
Lovely. Yeah. Amazing. I love it. I love it. And we need the extra screen, and we need you guys. So I'm so glad everything. We'll have the film forum back open, ready for a midsummer.
Thanks, Adam.
More cool theaters to enjoy our whisk away the hours or whatever, idle away.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll be relieved in 2 weeks. 2 weeks from today.
Yeah. Right, as we record
exciting
this.
Exciting to swing the doors open.
And I will be posting this in a week from tomorrow, just so I'll have this up for next week's show.
Oh, great.
Just to prompt people, if anything's not sold out. But
yeah, the tickets are set for the Becker series. Tickets are selling. And,
that's great.
Yeah, that's a good sign.
Very good sign. Yeah. All right, Mike. Great talking to you. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. It was finally great to bring you on the podcast. I've had on Karen and Bruce, which was, no easy thing to accomplish, but I was really glad to sit with both of them,
That's very cool. Yeah. I'm glad you got to talk to both of them. So, they don't do a lot of interviews. And
That's nice.
To spend half an hour listening to their stories, I think it'll be a lot of fun.
Really amazing. Yeah. Great. Okay. Thanks again for making time.
It's good to talk to you.
And I'll see you in a couple weeks.
Okay. Sure.
Tell me now if you came sneaking up behind, would you know me, see behind the smile? I can change like colors on a wall, hoping no one else will find the lies.
Very good. Again, check out filmforum.org for any details about the upcoming calendar and for tickets. Next up here is the filmmakers behind this new documentary called McQueen, Ian Bonnot and Peter Edegui. The film is being distributed by Bleecker Street. The film is a personal look at the extraordinary life, career, and artistry of Alexander McQueen, also nicknamed Lee, so if you hear that, that's why. Through exclusive interviews with his closest friends and family, recovered archives, and exquisite visuals and music, McQueen is an authentic celebration and thrilling portrait of an inspired yet tortured fashion visionary. Visit BleecerStreetMedia.com to get more information about where McQueen is going to be screening, because it's going to open up in a lot of theaters around the country. Right now, here is Ian, Peter, and my friend Pamela Keough, who is a contributor to Vanity Fair, among other magazines, and she's written a number of books. Yes, you can Google Pamela Keough Vanity Fair and read a bunch of her articles on fashion. Thank you. Here it is, Ian, Peter, and Pamela here on Film Wax Radio.
There's lots of people who say, I discovered McQueen. No one discovered Alexander McQueen. Alexander McQueen discovered himself.
I wasn't very good at school. I was always drawing clothes.
He was a very happy child.
He was passionate.
When Lee was 17, he said, I'll make you a couple of skirts. I've got to say, they fit like a glove.
He was drawing from all of these influences.
Jack the Ripper stalks his victims.
In the early years, Lee had seen violent things.
The darkness created genius.
Nobody could create emotions like McQueen.
You might find him distasteful, shocking.
Okay, let me just hear you. Just
can you hear me? Ian Bonnot. Nice to meet you guys.
Ian
we
Bonnot.
Had a lovely breakfast this morning.
Très bien. Très bien. Parfait. You are Belgian? Belgian?
Swiss-French.
Swiss-French. Excuse me. Okay.
No,
I thought so. Bonnot, but that's
Ian. Congrats on the World Cup situation.
very happy.
Yeah, he had everything covered. France, Spain,
Pam, I don't want to
Switzerland.
Croatian.
No, actually, that was the team I didn't support.
Yeah, he was there.
Peter Ettinger. How do you pronounce your name?
Peter Ettinger.
Ettinger. Okay. Yeah. And there was...
Perfect.
Well,
took me
after
to
you
about
15 me.
Years old to know how to pronounce my name. So,
and okay, so Ian, you are credited as the director of the film, McQueen. And Peter, you are considered co-director and writer of this magnificent documentary. And we're also... this is a particular thrill for me to be able to also introduce my longtime friend, Pamela Keough, who is a fashion writer and author. She was a contributor to Vanity Fair.
That's right.
I almost said Variety, I think.
I heard that. There was a big pause between Vanity and Fair.
I know, I just wanted to make sure.
They got to work on the marketing situation.
Nobody, no. It's just that I'm in that business. So, but I everything's fixed in the edit. Nobody hears any errors on my part in the show. I don't make errors.
Vanity Fair.
Oh, and last but not least, Noah is my intern. Noah Brown, who is intern. His mom and I went to summer camp together back in our younger days. And so I just want to make sure when the film is coming out.
Friday, in 2 days. Friday, 20th of July in Lawson. Yeah, two more. But the 20th of July in Los Angeles and New York first, in
perfect.
The cinemas.
Right, and then wide, as they say. And we should mention, Ian, I appreciate the fake French accent because it's going to help distinguish you from Peter, so thank you for that.
You're welcome. I've worked on it, despite 21 years in the UK, you know, it's still there, doesn't go away.
I saw you guys, I was sitting adjacent to you, at what's the name of the hotel? It's in Tribeca during the festival.
The Roxy.
We were all in the lounge, lobby, and you know, I ran into Jeff Hill, who I love and adore, and he was with you guys telling me all about the film. And I saw you guys; you were in between interviews, and I, you know, eye contact was made. So if I look familiar,
that's what he does.
Yeah,
I get it all the time. Anyway, I took Pamela to see your screening of McQueen, and we were both very moved, as she said.
Extremely.
It was a very beautiful film. Yeah. You don't even have to understand or feel comfortable around the subject of fashion, per se, to really appreciate the film.
I would almost say McQueen is beyond fashion.
I would agree with that.
But he was a creative force. Mm-hmm. That's what he was.
We couldn't agree more. And the other thing is, you know, I remember vividly when Asif Kapadia's wonderful Senna film came out. And I kind of remember...
Senna. That was a great film. Yeah.
I remember thinking, I don't want to go and see that. It's about Formula One racing. I'm not interested.
Right.
And then when you did go and see it, and you kind of were so immersed by the imagery and the emotions.
The archive and,
so
and right, the beautiful archival.
Absolutely. Mm. And we thought, I think good documentaries, that's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to take you into a world that you may never have thought about entering before.
And feel welcomed in that world.
Absolutely.
You know, and
really,
and engaged.
What it is really, it's passion. It's passion and desire and talent. Mm-hmm. Raw talent. But it's desire.
And there's a very inspirational story behind it, where he comes from and where he goes against all odds. And I think that resonates very well with loads of human beings. I think we all have a sense of misfit sometime in society. And I think Lee was potentially for us one of the ultimate misfits. And he still, you know, by the sheer will and the talent, he mastered his world.
Well, talk about his beginnings, because he grew up in a large family. In a relatively neighborhood
working
of London.
Class, East London, and one out of six. And his father was a taxi driver. His sister Janet McQueen, which is in the film, was a taxi driver. And you know, you really need to understand that this world is not, you know, people don't become world renowned fashion designers.
No.
So you really have to have something special to get to that stage.
And being gay. You know, he spoke about that. His father was a London cab driver, a Cockney.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think eventually they completely came around to it. But, you know, his mother was far more accepting and open and loving. And I think she made a joke like, you know, she knew instantly what he was like. But the father, you know, you have a Cockney cab driver, father, tough, tough guy. It's, you know, a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, and in the best of worlds, with very liberal parents, it's hard to discover yourself in that way and to come to terms and to be open and out about it. let alone in that type of culture, I guess, you know?
Absolutely.
And like you said, England, even though, again, that may be shifting a little bit, culturally speaking, but...
No, the class system is very, very strong.
Still, as much, let's say, as 30 years ago when Lee was young.
If you're the son of an earl or a duke, you could work at Starbucks.
You could drive a cab,
It doesn't matter, but even if you could go to Oxford and if your father is, say, a cab driver, you know, you're never going to hear the end of it.
Yeah.
Whereas, obviously, in America, money is the class system in America, mostly. If you have a lot of money, you're pretty well accepted.
Right.
As we see in the current situation in the White House.
It's like the your DNA. It's ancestrally passed along. This is where you are, your station.
Yeah.
So how did he transcend?
He was expected. I mean, you know, you came from that background, as Ian was saying, you know, the cab drivers in the family, but, your aspiration was to be a plumber or a car mechanic, or, you know, kind of some kind of laborer. And, you know, when Lee said, I want to make clothes, his dad was sort of assuming, where you go, if you want to make clothes, then you have to go and sell them in Petticoat Lane in one of the street markets of the East End.
Yeah.
The idea of sort of like, you know, and I think Lee always wanted to prove himself to his
absolutely.
Dad. You know, I think that was a part of the drive, you know,
to get to
Givenchy and say, Dad, look at me now, was a big thing for him.
But there was a smart thing. I mean... You know, tailoring is of the hand. So I think, you know, one of the first thing he did was he got an internship at Anderson Shepherd on Savile Row. Uh-huh. They make the suits for Prince Charles. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he had an ambition and a vision, even though he wasn't quite sure where it was going.
Okay.
You know, he knew enough, if I want to learn how to tailor and make jackets and trousers, I got to go to Savile Row, and Anderson Shepherd is the top. So in some sense, even when he was like 17 or 18, when he went there, he was aiming high. So he always had ambition.
Yeah. He was an outlier, though. I mean, this is not even somebody just with ambition. I mean, this is a somebody clearly who really is a genius, because the rapid pace that he not only ascended through the ranks, you know. I don't even know if he thought of it in that way. He just sort of was going to go as high and as fast as he could, correct? I mean,
I think it's very, you know, almost right now, you know, he passed at the tender age of 40. I think it's only even right now that people look back and actually how much he's managed to achieve in 18 years. You know, some people have said he lived 20 lives in that short space of time. Imagine some designers lasted, and thank God they lived such long life, but Lee did everything. I think what's really interesting as well is he never realized where he was going. He had a name, but where he was, I think he knew what he was creating, but I don't think he had a complete understanding, like all of us, of the impact he was having on people and other art form. And I think it's only now, and it's sad that sometimes only when people have gone that we look back and, oh my God, you know, I truly stand by what I'm going to say. I think he's slowly... People are realizing he's one of the greatest, and potentially the greatest fashion designer of all time. The number of silhouettes. You calculate, you can evaluate the influence on the designer on the number of women silhouettes he created. And, you know, we are on the 4, 5, 6 silhouettes or everything created. So basically, he was almost potentially more influential than Yves Saint Laurent, etc.
We should just, because you've said this a couple of times when we've been talking recently, and I kind of think that we know what that means. And you know,
I was going to say that the most, for the 21st century, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But silhouettes, you know...
What's a silhouette? Can you define it for people listening?
It's the line. But the silhouette that a designer gives the woman, and when it's an original silhouette, it changes the way that women are in society. It changes the way that...
Much in the sense that Coco Chanel was the first, I would say, modern couturier, because before then, women were very constrained in wearing bustles and corsets.
Right.
And she loosened them up, which is why you can still wear her silhouettes today. The little jacket, the skirt, it was movement.
I understand. Like
that. That's what you're looking at, which most Americans cannot do. No American designer can do what he did.
So is that why he wasn't...
You're looking at the line, and you're looking at the silhouette, and really you judge, you know, a designer is judged by his shoulders. You're literally looking at the jacket, like how good is the line? And nobody could cut a jacket like he did. Mm. And he got that out of working in Savile Row.
And also, because I think Savile Row is the thing that we all naturally talk about, But what we found when we were researching and then we were doing the interviews of the film is this, there's this, he's on Savile Row for 2 years. The full Savile Row training is 5 years. After those 2 years, he started going to other ateliers. And he learnt, you know, he went to Koji Tatsuno. He went to work at Berman and Nathan's theatrical costumiers. Mm. He went to work in Milan for Romeo Gigli. And he also worked for Red or Dead, which was a sort of like slightly fetish streetwear company that was very big in the late 80s, early 90s in London.
Right.
And you can see how in his designs, you can see this sort of like what he's absorbed from right. each of those schools.
He was like a
coming
sponge.
Together.
He was like a sponge.
Yeah. Yeah.
And his lifestyle, you know, going out and, you know, The street, the nightclubs, the club culture was massive.
Out dancing all night.
You know, people would create, they would go out creating their own clothing. So they would spend the day prepping themselves to go out. And that, I think that, in, you know, why is the catwalk and the fashion show so important for him? Because it's very much that ultimate moment where it doesn't matter if you can't actually reproduce it and sell it. It's about getting an emotion and a reaction at that particular moment.
Yeah,
we met someone. Yeah. I mean, sorry, we could really geek out about this, but this is such a wonderful little story that along those lines. We met someone who was very, very good friends with him while he was at St. Martin's, and he used to make her clothes to go out. They used to go to this club in Soho called Substation. One night he was supposed to turn up at her flat to kind of make something for them for that evening, and he knocked on the door. She opened it. He said, "Lee, where's the material? I thought you were going to make me something." Oh, fuck, I've forgotten. And he said, "Well, we'll find something."
Yeah.
And he wound up making her dress out of her bed covers. And she still got it. And she said it
that's
was
that's a designer.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That you can take. You can take like a hefty bag, right. Cut it. Yeah. Da-da-da-da. That's someone who knows what he's doing.
Yeah. I still prefer the curtains to the hefty bag, but I understand your point isn't well taken. But for people listening, again, I kind of want to be there. Avatar, sure. You know, because this may come as a stunning thing, but I'm not, you know, as fashion knowledgeable. But I've seen a lot of documentaries in the last number of years, but they're all household names, these designers in the States. But I myself have to say, I did not know about Lee McQueen. I don't know Lee Alexander McQueen. I don't know why that is. He just did not transcend here to the average person? Or to the design world in New York or in the States?
He had started to have a few shops in the US.
He did,
so I guess that was starting to feel true, and he left us a bit young. I think US audience was, right now, we feel confident, and I think our distributor, Blicker Street in the US, is very confident, because the first amazing retrospective of Lee's work, Savage Beauty, was at the Met, and he attracted half a million people.
Right.
And that was one of the biggest exhibition. Even the Met themselves, we could, you know, talk to them, they couldn't believe it. Became a blockbuster
every
exhibition.
Every day you would wait. I lived, you know, six blocks away, and you just every day you'd walk past and people would wait in lines like 6 hours to get it. I actually was able to go if I could comment on it. And I will say, you know, I cover fashion. We'd heard the name Alexander McQueen coming over from London, and we'd heard about these nutty fashion shows, and they were crazy, and people were like, "Oh my God, Jack the Ripper," and so we, you know. People who followed fashion, you know, knew of him. But I will say, when I went to that show, I wasn't expecting anything. I was like, I'll go and see the show and it'll be great. And I got in line and so on. But when I went through it, I was like, got teary-eyed. I was weeping. And you went from room to room to room. So one room, it was the Highland Rape. So you felt the tartan.
These were fashion shows.
This was his clothing.
Right.
His clothing at the Met.
No, I get it. Okay. But those themes that you're referring to, I just want to.
They were all over
you
London.
You mentioned Jack the Ripper. You mentioned
Highland Rape.
The name and theme of the show.
Yeah,
correct.
Yes,
these were during Fashion Week. His show, right?
In London, Fashion Week. Yeah,
and they were just beyond. I mean, I've seen lots of these presentations, and they're nothing like what was in your film. Again, called, by the way, McQueen. These were such cinematic, spectacular.
They were experiences. It was like going to a Broadway show.
Yes,
I would say.
Yes, right. It was.
But
like,
if I could just finish what I wanted, so I went to the show, and every room it was, you know, the Highland or the, you know, the different themes, and I got teary eyed, and I wasn't expecting anything. I thought, I'll go see the show and it'll be great, and I literally got. Yeah. And what I realized is
why
we don't have this talent in America. What America does best is sportswear. We do jeans, a polo shirt, Ralph Lauren
athletic,
type stuff,
athletic. Casual, that is leisure
really,
wear.
That's that is really what America invented. So we don't have the couture, the level. What he did coming at with like, you know, and I looked at it, it was material and a needle and a thread. And there was something about it. It was a visceral. You felt it. And you felt his talent. Mm-hmm. You felt his desire. It was sexy. It was depressing. It was lonely. It was, and you're just looking at mannequins. It was like, yeah. God Almighty.
If I may jump about the you comment about America. I think with haute couture and high fashion, men or women, there's a commitment in getting dressed. And I think right now with our society, we need to be fast, etc. I like my clothing. What I'm wearing today, you have to carry yourself a certain way. I can't start running. I've got shorts, but they're, you know, inspired by North African shorts from Givenchy, and they had, you know, they're not. You've got to have a commitment. I think in the US, people want to be able to, you know, clothing has to be part of their life. And potentially, it's a little bit more of that in Europe. You need to adapt your life to your clothing slightly. And, yeah. And I completely understand that it put off people. But it's a sort, you know, when you put certain shirt, if you button up to the top and the way it carries.
Constricting. It's constricting. You have to get used to that.
Constricting
yes.
helps you carry yourself and project an imagery of yourself, which some people embrace and some not.
No. I always have a lot of. I always marvel at people who obviously are present. You know,
I totally judge a man by his shoes. Absolutely. So yeah,
thank God I put on my shoes today.
Socks and watches. That's how you know a man.
So glad I put on my good shoes
it's
today.
It's interesting though what you were saying because you know when he first came to America, you know he did an interview in which he sort of like said, you know, how much he loved the energy of New York. This is sort of around 95.
Oh, I'm sure he did.
He loved the energy of New York, but he said, you know, but Americans are kind of they can be quite conservative in their dress sense and. I'm going to come and shake things up.
He liked
to do that.
You go to London, you know, and they're like, oh my God, I can't believe they're wearing that. It's, yeah, Americans are a bit more, you know. But
It's funny because, I mean, I think that they're kind of almost the opposite, but I'm thinking maybe in a different way because, you know, he didn't grow up in the punk era. He was after that, right? I mean, so
no, but there was a lot of nightclubbing.
It
wasn't punk, but it was maybe the 5 years after, 10 years. But it was definitely a lot of nightclub era, and like Kate Moss was going to the club, and they were all great outfits. And
punk never left England, even if it's not in exactly. It's an attitude. I think what we were saying about that structure of society, and a lot of people have to rebel massively towards it. So in England, people tend to go into the extremes, you know.
Yeah.
And the creatives overall, I would say, you know, most of the rock stars, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, except Mick Jagger, you know, they were all from the lower classes pushing up. So,
sure. McQueen is directed by Ian Bonnot and co-directed and written by Peter Ettinger.
But we very much made the film together. So,
but I understand. You know. Yeah. I should just say it's a collaborative effort. What it goes into writing, to shift gears just for a second. Is that like something that you're doing during the editing phase where you have the content, you have the archive, and now you have to kind of write a script so you know how to edit the film and present?
It's interesting because I'm still asking myself what that question is.
Well, I know a couple of writers for documentaries, and you know, it's an interesting...
I kind of like fell into it a few years back, and I've done two or three now as a writer. And it's differed. What I've done has differed on each of those. But I think the first time I really thought this... how extraordinary this medium could be was on a film called Listen to Me, Marlon.
Which is one of my favorites from a couple of years back. I love that.
Thank you.
I love that documentary.
About Marlon Brando.
It was on Showtime, I believe.
That was Showtime, yeah. And we had this extraordinary cache of audio archive, and, you know, you just started to think, God, it's you know, sometimes the structures and conventions of dramatic fiction, filmmaking and writing can be, you know, they can be a bit boring, frankly. Whereas, you know, what was great about Listen to Me, Marlon, where I was present every single day in the edit with working with the director, Stephen Riley, we were literally just sort of like improvising the sequences. We had a kind of like a roadmap. And, you know, it was kind of like writing onto the timeline of the edit. And that was just thrilling to be a part of. I think with this one, I mean, we started off, we had a sort of exchange, really, of Ian coming in with visual ideas, and I was kind of feeding in ideas about the structure of the piece. And very, very soon, we sort of like decided that we were going to tell the story through a handful of fashion shows. At least those were going to be the main anchor points of the whole narrative.
Good idea. I'm endorsing that.
Well,
it worked out real well.
He always said, you know, if you want to know me, look at my work. And we thought, well, we'll take you at your word, Lee.
This could have... Oh, and I know that now that you bring that particular point of it's about the work, it's not... This film also avoids all tawdriness, all tabloid aspects, which it could easily have done. In fact, I think you got family interviews, which were probably very difficult to figure out. But you were able to do that based on that. Yeah, because you know. I'm sure there were, you know, other projects pitched which would have made more out of his lifestyle and his friends and his the club life you mentioned, Pamela. And his, you know, being gay and then ultimately,
you know, for if a designer, I'm not spoiling, he wasn't, I mean, he wasn't, there were, it wasn't
they were all that,
that
way.
Bad.
No, no, you no, it's like very true. But he did die. He you know, his best friend committed suicide.
Izzy Blow, yeah.
And then he ultimately did, not to give away too much, but that should be, it is a fact.
What I loved about your documentary is you showed his talent. You walked out of there and you saw why he mattered and you missed him. You know, I was like, God, I wish he could have been around to give us more.
Yeah.
You saw his unhappiness, which I, as an American, we had no sense. We didn't get that at all. We just didn't make it over here. And then you saw, like, he was a son. He was a brother. You saw how much his family loved him. And I appreciate that.
And he loved
that.
Them as well.
Right.
He was very close to them.
I appreciated that because, he was very close to his mother and he was proud of where he came from. And he was, you know, a McQueen, and they were Scottish, and his dad was like, and I like that because you humanized him, because I think so many, especially fashion designers, you know, they act like Karl Lagerfeld. He's like from Mount Olympus. He has no mother, no sibling. He remembers nothing from the past. You know, so there's a lot of mythology that goes on with those designers, and I really liked how you humanized him. So. Yeah.
Well, we really tried to avoid to create an icon. He was already an icon.
He is an icon.
But we wanted to humanize that angle. And I think to understand some of the issues that led to his tragic death, I think you really need to understand that those issues are shared by every human being. You know, we have all those fragilities within us, the mental health issues, etc. And we, Peter and I, really feel that, you know, there you mentioned some very... And you've got very famous people everywhere, but we are all humans. And I think that's how, as filmmakers, you just can touch an audience, because you need to strip away and just bring back what exactly every day to day, blue collar, upper class, wherever you are, you just have got the same potential struggles.
Nicely put. Nice place to kind of leave it. I'm just going to remind people that McQueen opens in New York and L.A. Friday, July
20th.
Thank you. And then it'll go wide. So check your local listings, if there is such a thing anymore. I mean, go online and Google McQueen, the documentary, and we'll keep people abreast of that. Pamela, how can people find your writing? And
Google me, like everyone else. I don't know. I'm on Google. Vanity Fair. But if I could say a final thing to your audience,
I would say, go see
this documentary. I can't put it strongly enough. You get a sense of his genius, his talent, his sorrow, his joys. Mm-hmm. I felt like I spent time with him, and I felt very fortunate to be in the audience. So that's what I would say.
Thank you.
How much do we owe you?
Well, we'll hopefully all so do much. This. Okay, guys, we'll hopefully do this all again with the next projects.
Thank you. Very nice meeting you all.
Music on this episode is brought to you by the Jayhawks from their brand new album Back Road and Abandoned Motels. Available now, where music is sold and downloaded and streamed and stolen.
You know how to fly on the wings of disaster. You try to stand still, you keep going faster and faster. You thought it'd be easy in California. The tables will turn and...
Okay, I'm real excited about this. This is a guy who I have a lot of respect for. He's done so much for the independent film industry and the community. The movie is called Bernard and Hugh. It's a comedy with a stellar cast. It's based on a screenplay by legendary Pulitzer Prize winning author Jules Pfeiffer. Bernard and Hugh is a comedy about two old friends who reconnect after 30 years apart and the women who complicate their lives. Mirvish has taken on the project along with producers Mike Ryan and Dana Altman. You'll want to see it with the has a great some great comic actors are in this, including David Koechner, Jim Rash, Sasha Alexander, Richard Kind, Nancy Travis, and Mae Whitman, among others. Please go check it out. I can tell you right now it's available on iTunes and Amazon, and you can go to BernardandHueyMovie.com and find out how else you can see the film, get on their newsletter, etc. Here in the meantime is my conversation with filmmaker and festival programmer Dan Mirvish on FilmWax Radio.
Every 25 years, right? I drop in, right? What are you staring at? Why are you standing there with your finger up your nose?
I hate everything about my life. I'm not progressing. Where am I going to be in 25 years?
Dead? Wait, Huey?
Are you on the lam? Is that what's happening?
Get back here, Huey!
Define lam.
I didn't even know you had a daughter.
I mean, I've been with a lot of women. They're not all careful.
Do you know that your daughter has the makings of a truly brilliant cartoonist?
Graphic novelist, oh. Please.
You're a sociopath.
You're not supportive of my work.
Yes, I am.
I don't understand a word you're saying.
Well, then tell the half-eaten pizza on my bed that you have not been upstairs.
You put that thing in cruise control? Oh.
I mean, is that it? In order to play it safe.
Dan Mirvish, you are one of the founders of Slam Dance.
Yes. Slamdance Film Festival, exactly.
And that's been going on now for how many years?
Almost 25 years. We're heading into our 25th year.
Difficult to wrap your mind around that?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I think that our longevity, though, has really come from just kind of not changing too much. I mean, really sticking to our mantra of first-time directors with humble budgets and no distribution, and physically, like, we haven't really changed much. We're for most of those years, we've been in, just right across the street from Sundance at this place called the Treasure Mountain Inn, and these two, pretty small screening rooms. But, because of that, we've been able to weather, a lot of the economic storms and sponsorship ups and downs and politics up and down, and we've just stayed in Sundance's shadow, but meanwhile, very quietly, generated some pretty amazing alumni, everyone from the Russo brothers to Christopher Nolan, to Ryan Johnson, Lynn Shelton, Lena Dunham. Anyway, so we've had these amazing alumni, Sean Baker, the Safdie brothers, the Zellner brothers.
Lots of brothers.
Lots of brothers, yeah. And anyway, I think our alumni have grossed something like $16 billion worldwide, and that seems to change literally every week, especially with Infinity Wars. So it's fun to know that we've had a small hand in helping develop a lot of these great careers over the years.
And I wonder, like, because it did start off as such a maverick festival. I mean, I suppose that spirit is still there, but on another level, it's like one of those festivals that give people a lot of cachet. There's a lot of pedigree now to getting your film in, the Slam Dance Film Festival. I mean, it has been that way for many years. It's part of the festival circuit, is it not? So you kind of have to grapple with wanting to still have that outsider credibility, and yet you're also an insider festival too. Correct.
Well, I certainly don't think of ourselves as insiders. I certainly have institutional low self-esteem about the whole thing. How other people see us is another matter. But yeah, no, I mean, we still don't get the we still feel like we don't get respect. You know, I think from our alumni, we do. From anyone that's actually been there, I think they see the value. And a lot of these alumni have not just been involved, you know, just for 1 week and then they're gone. They've been involved as programmers. You know, the Russo brothers were programmers for 3 years. Ryan Johnson was, Emma Thomas, Chris Nolan's wife. She was a programmer for a number of years. So we have this great kind of secret community where we all kind of know each other, and you know, which really is helpful, you know, as filmmakers to sort of have these great little connections. But honestly, I think the festival world has also changed in the last 25 years. I'm interested to hear what you think. But, you know, 25 years ago, the real cachet for film festivals was how many films did you get picked up? You know, that was the metric that Sundance used, that, you know, South By used 15 years ago, that Toronto used for a while. You know, how many films were getting acquired?
And by picked up, you're talking about being acquired. So how many are you selling to distribution? Yeah.
Yeah, the metric of success that everyone uses for festivals that they use themselves or that, you know, the press uses is how many Oscar winners did you get out of the festival?
Right.
And so because of that, you know, Toronto, it's all about Toronto, Telluride, and even Sundance and some of the other festivals, you know, it's very much about, you know, how, you know, who's going to, which film is going to be an Oscar nominee the next year. I mean, that's how they sell their success to their own sponsors and press and everything. Honestly, in either metric, you know, Slamdance hasn't really cared about either of those things. You know, I mean, when films do get picked up, great. You know, I mean, Paranormal Activity was a Slamdance film, got picked up by the festival. But we always measure our own success by a very different metric than anyone else uses, and that's by the success of our alumni. You know, because we're focused on first-time filmmakers, you know, their first films rarely are successful, you know, honestly.
Right.
And because of that, we sort of lower everyone's expectations. They're not, you know, we don't stress out about big bidding wars and things like that. And the filmmakers wind up having a much better time at the festival because of that, you know. But that said, you know, a lot of our shorts get turned into features. I mean, Napoleon Dynamite started as a Slamdance short and things like that. And actually, you know, ironically, though, you know, my own film, Bernard and Huey, which played as the out of competition, of course, at the closing night film, that got picked up for distribution at this year's festival. So we've actually still done pretty well with that metric, but it's a metric that nobody seems to notice anymore. So anyway, all of which is to say, you know, Slamdance, I think, has its sort of unique niche in the festival ecosphere, where people like us, they, you know, that's great. And if not, you know, if they ignore us, that's cool, whatever.
Well, I mean, I think you have credibility, and maybe this is what you're getting at. I think the credibility comes from the film community, all those brothers, the sisters, the cousins.
Yeah, exactly.
No, but all those alumni, as you mentioned, that are the bread and butter of independent film, of, you know, love Slamdance and consider that part of their... are proud to talk about it as part as their own history, and their own story. And I have countless filmmakers on the show over the years, and maybe that's how you found out about it, though, that really value their relationship and their having a partnership with Slamdance. So I was really thrilled when you reached out, not only to talk about Bernard and Huey, which we're going to talk about momentarily, by the way, available on iTunes, but also... to connect with you and Slamdance. You know, I think there's a handful of festivals out there that are navigating that interesting balance between, you know, survival, frankly, and also being a real filmmaker's festival.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thanks. I mean, that's great to hear. And I think that is the kind of the unique thing about Slamdance is sort of the community aspect among other filmmakers. I mean, all the people who run the festival are still active working filmmakers, and we're really one of the few festivals that are like that, and all the programming is done by alumni every year, and so we don't have this cadre of professional, you know, festival people running the festival, which sometimes means the festival isn't always the most professional, but that's fine.
I understand.
That's what we like about it.
Yeah.
So yeah, it does have a little bit of a unique place in the world. And speaking of which, I mean, what's also unique is we kind of blend world cinema, you know, international films with U.S. films, and that's led to some. Yeah, I mean, we showed Bong Joon-ho's first film in the U.S., and that was his first trip to the States was to come to Slam Dance.
Wow. I did not.
And, you know, we've stayed in touch with him. So, yeah, and a lot of, you know, German filmmakers, Hank and Loper. And
we cut out. Say that again. What was the last thing you said after?
I was saying...
after Bong Joon-ho.
Frederick Forestier from France and Hank and Loken from Germany have been some of our successful people over the years, and that's also been fun too. As a filmmaker, for us to then travel the world and meet up with these guys, you know. So I think we're unique, and I think that's been the secret to our longevity, is to not exactly copy any other festival, but to kind of do our own thing, our own way, for better or for worse. But it has meant that we've stuck around as long as we have. I don't know why, but we have.
So. Well, just glad that you have.
Yeah,
just lastly, what number of festivals coming up this January?
Right, this will be our 25th, or we're heading into our 25th year. So we started in January 95, and this will be our 25th festival. The math gets a little fuzzy because our 25th festival, but it's 2019.
Right.
But that is because you don't, it's like with birthdays, you don't count zero. Anyway, so it is our 25th festival. So it's sort of a year of 25th anniversary. Right. 25th anniversary.
It's your silver festival.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
At some point, we'll catch up to Sundance.
And what's your current role now? Like, what is your position with the festival?
Sure. Thankfully, I don't have any year round responsibilities, which is good. My one of my partners, Peter Baxter, kind of does that year round, aided by a couple people in the office. But I am going to be on the programming committee a little bit this year for some of the out-of-competition films. And then during the festival, I go out there every year, and I'm kind of the de facto mentor for the new filmmakers, and I read a poem on opening night, and sometimes I'm the host at closing night. And, when we do it, I'm the host for the Hot Tub Summit, which is the wettest panel discussion in Park City. And so I think we'll probably be doing that again this year.
People should go right now, actually, since you're listening to me and Dan speaking about Slam Dance, go to their website and sign up for their newsletter so you can get all the updates leading up to the 25th festival.
And if you've got a film, now's the time to start submitting.
So. Yeah. Where are we at with that? Are you're still in the early submissions, I assume, right?
Yeah. I think we have like early, regular, and late deadlines, and so I think we're sort of in the early phases now. But people are definitely starting to submit films and get them in there. And we have, unlike a lot of festivals, we have a strict no waiver policy. Even when I submit my own films, I have to pay the entry fee. But that levels the playing field. So I mean, but the nice thing is when you come to Park City, I mean it is a destination unto itself. You know, you're there the same time as Sundance. And so, I mean, I always tell people, look, I meet more people in a week in Park City than I do in a year in LA. And I live a block from a studio, you know, so I think it's been worth it. And I think for most of the filmmakers who have come over the years, it's been worth it to come. And part of the fun is also, you know, teaming up with other filmmakers from around the world, to share a condo, to fit 20 people, you know, in one bed or whatever it is. And that honestly is part of the fun of going to Park City. That's where friendships and collaborations come from. I mean, Chris Nolan met Wally Pfister at Slam Dance and worked with him for, you know, 10 or 15 years after that. I met my DP and my producer on Bernard and Huey at Slam Dance. So, it really is for actors, filmmakers of any stripe. It really is the best place to network in a short amount of time.
Right. And it's small enough. How many features do you typically ballpark do you show in the course of the festival?
We go between 10 and 12 narrative features in competition, about an equal number of docs, and then
and then about 10 films out of competition for features, and then about 60 shorts of various of all kinds. We're an Oscar qualifying short festival,
or
festival for shorts. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so that's another nice perk, is that if you win as a short, you you know, you get Oscar qualified. So
is that which is if you win, so that's an audience award, or is it a jury?
No, if you win the jury, and the Academy has pretty strict rules.
Right.
You have to have a separate jury for animation, short doc, and short narrative. And then that's one of the ways that you qualify. You know.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, just because I'm curious.
They have this list. They have this... Yeah, they have kind of an obscure list of like 30 festivals that are Oscar qualifying festivals, mm-hmm. and they it does not get updated very often. I think we got on that list pretty early by our third year or something, mm-hmm. and have stuck around. But they have it's an odd list that really should get updated quite a bit more than it is. But anyway, but it's a nice thing.
Do you know what? Have you read that list?
It's definitely a nice thing. Yeah, yeah, and it's and I know like really good festivals that aren't on the list.
Yeah,
old festivals that are no longer around. Are still on the list, so it's,
that's not good.
No, that's not good at all.
It's not good for a film. It's not good for short filmmakers, because you know that's a little attrition there. But I'm on the short screening committee for the New York Film Festival. I have no idea.
Oh, great!
I have no idea if they're on the. They don't take.
I think they probably are. Yeah, it's they're one of these old legacy festivals that probably is on that list.
Well, you know, they don't even take feature submissions anymore as of like this last year, because they weren't they were accepting fees, but they really never took
those films
unsolicited. Yeah, they never took them. So they're like, this is like a Ponzi scheme. We should stop doing this before we get into trouble. You know,
right? Yeah. Well, that was honest of them, and that's good. Yeah.
They wanted to make sure that they didn't come off unseemly. You know, which is.
Yeah.
Does speak well for them. So anyway, I watched about 100 shorts in the last few months.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Well, I'm real thrilled. Thank you very much. Take care. And no, Bernard and Huey. I'm sorry, Bernard and not Huey.
Huey.
It is Bernard and Huey.
Yes,
sorry.
It is.
It's
it
so
is Bernard
ingrained
and
now. I'm thinking, well, that's an old title, and it kind of is an old title, right? I mean, was that the original screenplay written by Jules Pfeiffer in the late 50s? Is that when he started the first? Version of this story, or
the
original incarnation?
So the story goes that he was a cartoonist for the Village Voice for 44 years, a Pulitzer Prize winning cartoonist. And Bernard and Huey are these two mm-hmm. characters that showed up from the beginning of the series, from his comics, in 1957. So... And they were these kind of recurring characters in all of his work, but especially the cartoon strip. And then from 1982 to 86, mm-hmm. he had a regular monthly 6-panel strip in the back of Playboy magazine, you know, for everyone that was reading it for the cartoons. And that was called Bernard and Huey. And then based on the success of that, and then these characters were these kind of two middle-aged guys. They started as they were these two kind of post-collegiate guys hanging around the East Village trying to get laid. And then he kind of brought them back as these middle-aged guys trying the same thing. And this was all kind of in a satire of, you know, masculinity. And as Jules puts it, you know, it was a satire of the people that were reading Playboy. But then Showtime actually asked commissioned him to write a screenplay in 1986 based on all this other work. He wrote the screenplay, but the week he turned it in, they changed ownership and they changed their whole business model to boxing or comedy or whatever it was at the time. And they never paid him for it. And they gave him the script back and said, here you go. And so he had a producing partner at the time. They tried to sell it as a Hollywood script and had no luck. And, you know, in 1986, there wasn't, you know, exactly the same appetite for making independent films. So they just it stuck on a shelf for 30 years. And then I kind of came into the picture about 5 or 6 years ago when I read an interview with Jules, just in the Chicago Sun-Times said he's living in his 80s.
Not Playboy magazine.
In Hamptons. Right. No, yeah. It was the Chicago Sun-Times. Said he was living in the Hamptons and teaching and writing graphic novels, writing plays, still very active, still very healthy. And at the very end of this interview, it had a little throwaway line that said, oh, he has several unproduced screenplays. And I thought, well, whatever they are, they're probably pretty good. So
it's gold.
I reached out to him. Yeah. So I reached out to him. I mean, this is a guy who's won a Pulitzer, an Oscar, two Obies, was a Tony nominee. I mean, that's better than an EGOT. That's a Putin. And
he didn't get a Grammy, so whatevs.
Anyway, are you still there? You can still hear me.
Yeah, right? I know. Once in a while we cut out, but so, no worries. Okay.
Yeah. So I reached out to him, and he said, oh, yeah, I think I got some screenplays, but I've been divorced so many times. Everything's in storage. I don't exactly know where everything is, but let me look, and I'll get back to you in 4 months. So, all right, so 4 months went by. I reached out to him again. Oh, yeah, I still haven't found anything. Try me again in 4 months. Another 4 months. And this went on for a year and a half. In 4 month intervals, exactly. And I actually met his daughter, Hallie Pfeiffer, who had a film coincidentally at Slamdance, but she didn't know where any of the scripts were. And finally, another Slamdance guy, my friend Kevin DeNovis, knew I was having this correspondence with Jules, and he said, oh, I think I remember reading one of these screenplays. It was in Scenario Magazine, which some of your listeners may remember in the late 90s was a magazine that would publish mainly produced screenplays, but every now and again, an unproduced one.
Oh, okay.
And I said, well, that's great, Kevin. Do you still have your magazines? He said, oh, no, I just got divorced. Everything's in storage. I don't know where anything
call
is.
Back in 4 months.
Yeah, exactly. So thankfully, the one library in America that still had the magazine was the Academy Library in L.A., which is not far from my house. So I go over there, read the magazine, Scenario Magazine, and sure enough, there's Bernard and Huey. And I read the script, and I thought it was great. It was still timeless and timely and funny. And I called Jules, and I said, oh, I found it, Bernard and Huey. He goes, oh, yeah, that's the one, Bernard and Huey. Mm-hmm. Up until that point, I didn't even know what the title was we were looking for. He said, oh, but I think my assistant sent them an abridged version. What you read may not have been the final thing. I said, oh, well, let's call your assistant. Maybe she has an old floppy disk or something. Oh, no, she's dead. Oh, my gosh, that's horrible news. I'm sorry.
I shouldn't laugh
at that.
Yeah.
I said, Well, what about your agent? Didn't you have a big Hollywood agent at the time? Oh, no, he's dead, too. You know, oh, my gosh, that's bad enough having a live agent.
When he refers to people like as my old assistant, he doesn't mean, well, he means they're old is what he means.
Yeah,
were, you know, like a prior assistant, but they're in their 90s. So, yeah.
Well, or in this case, dead.
Yeah.
So
right.
She was dead. The agent was dead. I said, what about your lawyer? No longer among the counted. He's dead. And so thankfully, we tracked down the old producing partner that he had from the 80s, a guy named Michael Brandman, very nice guy who was still alive, still married, still had his archives. And he found a copy of the script and a finished type copy of it. And then we kept looking. And we found that Jules had actually donated some of his archives to the Library of Congress and had forgotten about it. And so I sent a buddy of mine, my friend Mike Schubick in D.C., to the Library of Congress, and he found the original handwritten copy of the script.
Mm-hmm.
So, because, of course, Jules always had the dead assistant to do the typing for him. So, you know, and then Jules is like, I'm 87. When are we making this thing already? You know, so we had to make the movie, you know. And
yeah.
And he's 89 now, you know, and thankfully loves the movie. So that's
oh, great. He did love it.
Yeah.
He was so good. Well, it must be like a gift from Manna. I mean, think about it. Some young guys came in and, you know, like gave life to this carcass. I mean,
at
least this body that was in cold storage or whatever.
Yeah.
Amazing story. So somehow or other, though, you were able to get, I'm just going to name a few of these people.
Sure.
It's pretty amazing. Jim Rash, David Koechner, Mae Whitman, Sasha Alexander, Nancy Travis, Richard Kind is in it. It's a veritable who's who. Was this like packaged by one agency or something? Or
Oh no.
Oh no.
All very different agents. Yeah, I mean, that said, I mean, that is kind of how we start the casting process is by going to the different agencies.
Okay.
That, you know, you either had relationships with or knew people at. And and you get the agents excited, and then they pass it on to the actors, and then they get in. But it's a lot of different agencies.
Did the name Jules Pfeiffer have any cachet at this point? I mean, anybody worth their salt is going to be impressed by this guy, obviously, and his legacy is tremendous. But I wonder if in today's Hollywood, if that applies. I don't know.
Well, I... people that, you know, because if you just say, oh, this is a guy who wrote Carnal Knowledge, they're like, wait, what? You know, and some people don't remember the 1971 Mike Nichols film that, you know, got an Oscar nomination for Anne Margaret. So you kind of have to explain that to especially some of the younger agents.
Sure.
I mean, thankfully, most of the cast are of an age that they remembered Pfeiffer. You know, some of them had sort of more direct connections. Richard Kind is friends with Jules. He knew him. And I had met Richard, and I knew that he knew him, so that worked out well. Jim Rash had been in a Pfeiffer play in college.
Oh, wow, okay. So, yeah.
Yeah. Same with Nancy Travis. And,
sure.
And Sasha Alexander had actually directed a short based on a Pfeiffer play, or a Pfeiffer short story. So a lot of them had these kind of tangential connections to him already. So I think actors of a certain age certainly were familiar with him. But other people, you know, other actors like Mae Whitman, I don't think she knew who he was, you know, from Spit. And then she looked him up and she's like, oh, wow, that guy, you know.
Yeah.
So, and then was very impressed. So.
Yeah. And then it's also nice because when they go and they check out, like you got somebody, some young actor or someone associated with the film, and then they go watch Carnal Knowledge. You know, that they're going to come back and they're going to be, that changed my world. That just, I mean, you can't see it. So we should probably mention or at least describe the film a little bit more. You have these two old college friends, right, who were very close friends back in the their college years, but then grew apart shortly thereafter, sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah.
And are reunited. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. You're doing a great job describing that.
I don't know about that. When roguish Huey and nebbish... No. So Huey comes back to finds Bernard. Meanwhile, they're very different looking now in their middle-aged years, right? And they're reunited. And it's a bit of an odd couple story, too. Bernard is kind of on the outs.
Well, yeah, I mean, Huey, when they first knew each other, and we have flashbacks with two younger actors portraying them, you know, Huey was originally kind of the alpha male ladies' man of the two, and Bernard was his nebbishy wingman. And then, but 25 years later, they've almost kind of traded places.
Yeah.
Bernard is now this swinging bachelor in New York, and Huey kind of looks like a bum and shows up on his doorstep and basically moves into his apartment. And, And then Bernard winds up dating Huey's daughter, played by Mae Whitman, and Huey starts dating all the women in Bernard's life, and it gets very complicated and hopefully funny too.
Mm-hmm. So how did you navigate that? Because it's like that is very, very much Jules Pfeiffer age situation.
Sorry, can you repeat the question, Adam?
Yeah. I was wondering. Yeah, sure. How did you navigate figuring out how to bring that into contemporary times? And because that kind of storyline does feel very much like Jules Pfeiffer age, 70s, 80s humor and situation comedy. You know, how does that go over in the teens here?
Yeah, exactly. Well, first of all, I mean, when I first read the script and this, you know, the script was set in 19, the contemporary scenes were in 1986 and the flashbacks were to 1960. And I said to Jules, look, on my kind of indie film budgets, you know, it's hard enough to do one period movie, much less two period movies.
That's
so do you mind if we move everything up 30 years? And he was fine with that. He was totally cool with that. And that certainly saved us a lot of, you know, money. But it also was a nice way, I think, as a director, whenever you're adapting someone else's material or directing someone else's screenplay, you need to find your own way in emotionally to the material. And by moving everything up 30 years, it made it much easier for me to connect with the material because I'm about the same age as the characters are, as Jules was when he wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the flashback scenes were to, you know, sort of my post-college years. And so that made it easy for me to connect with. And the interesting thing was when Jules and I kind of revisited the script, we really didn't have to change much. I mean, I wanted to keep the original dialogue because that's the whole point of having a Pfeiffer script is the Pfeiffer dialogue.
Well, sure.
And even plot-wise, there was remarkably little we had to change. And I think ironically, I think if someone was making this maybe 15 years ago, there would have been a temptation to make, for example, Mae Whitten plays an aspiring cartoonist, and in the original script, she her particular goal is to become a cartoonist in the back of the Village Voice. And Bernard works at the Village Voice. And so, because if you think about it, in the mid-80s, that was sort of the apex of cartooning in American culture, and that's what Pfeiffer himself was doing. But in a way to update that, we changed it to she wants to be a graphic novelist. And ironically, Pfeiffer himself is now a graphic novelist. He has a graphic novel coming out in 2 weeks.
He does.
From Norton. Yeah. And so what was nice about that is it required very little actual changes to the script itself. Like, we just literally changed, you know, Village Voice to Norton, you know. But if someone was making this 15 years ago, I think the temptation would have been to make it much more, oh, she wants to be a web designer or a digital this or a digital that. And that there's a lot about the movie that actually would have needed to have changed in a way that doing it, waiting 30 years, remarkably little had to change. And I think even language, you know, has become cyclical, and phrases are cyclical in language. And you get, you know, post-ironic uses of, you know, ironic uses of hip and dig, and then they're post-ironic another 30 years later, you know. So I think it was kind of a fun thing for all of us to revisit this, you know, to for the actors to act, for me to direct, and the cinematographer to cinematograph, to the way we filmed it was in a way that was still kind of a little bit of an homage to the period, but still make it contemporary. So it's a tricky balance, but I think we pulled it off in a kind of timeless way. That was the goal.
Really entertaining and a lot of fun. And I mean, David Koechner is also just one of those effortlessly funny individuals.
Oh yeah,
you know. So you, and as is Richard Kind, and you know. So I mean, it's like you got two of the funniest guys working today in films, you know, and whatever, yeah. You know.
That's not too shabby.
Not at all. So right now it's on iTunes. I know that for a fact.
Yes. Where else? Yeah. I mean, we just had a really great festival run with it. It played at close to 30 festivals in 5 continents. And actually, just last week, won another award in...
Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
Jules won the best script prize.
Oh, but wait, it just won another award last week, you said?
Last week, yeah, yeah.
What festival was that at?
It's called the Mount Fuji Atami Film Festival.
Oh, of course. Sure.
Yeah.
I'm on that screening committee, too.
Oh, okay. And and so it was very nice that Jules won the best script prize there, and he had just won the best screenplay prize at the Manchester England Film Festival a few months ago.
Well, this has got to be got to kind of tickle him, right?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely.
At 89, or is that what you said?
89? Yeah, yeah, at 89.
That he's
I called him last week. He said, "Oh my gosh, I'm big in Japan and England. They love me there." Exactly. So, but yeah, I mean, his work always. He traveled very well. I mean, even when he was doing cartoons, you know, it was, he had fans from Fellini and Bertolucci in Italy were huge fans of his cartoons. And, Alain René directed one of his screenplays. So, yeah, his work has always traveled particularly well. It's been a lot of fun for him. And he's done a lot of great interviews.
So you did it sounds like a 30 plus festivals, and then
Oh, right. Yeah. And then we got distribution actually at Slamdance. We got picked up by Freestyle, which is part of Byron Allen's Entertainment Studios. And they gave it a coast to coast theatrical release started on June 8th, played in New York, the Village East, in LA at Lemley's Monica and a bunch of other places. And it's still playing in theaters. I mean, it was a day and date release with VOD, but it actually is playing from Alaska to Nebraska coming up in the next few weeks. Literally on Monday, it's playing in Anchorage, and then August 16th, it's in Omaha. August 17th in Lincoln, playing in New Jersey on Sunday. You can see it in New Jersey.
Where in New Jersey? Do you remember?
It's the Acme Screening Theater, the Acme Screening Room. In some weird place, or I'm sure it's not weird if you live there.
well, you don't know.
In New Jersey.
We can figure it out. Don't.
That's it, and I can. Yeah.
Or look like it up. It's up to you.
Yeah, Acme screening. Well, it took me a little while. Anyway, but it's screening there. Mm-hmm. That was our New Jersey premiere. Well, it's screened on Saturday and screen night, and then it's screening again on this coming Sunday afternoon in New Jersey. And then I'm gonna keep touring with the film all through the fall. We've got some dates coming up in North Carolina and St. Louis and Dallas and other places. So. And some of those are going to be in conjunction with me guest lecturing at different film schools and colleges too.
Right. So and I'm sorry because people should know that we did try to coordinate this before your New York.
That's okay.
I want to put my mea culpas out there just because. And for whatever. I mean, I'm just glad that you got back in touch and that we made this happen.
Yeah.
You know.
Well. I think the reality is with indie film these days is as a filmmaker, you shouldn't just focus on your opening weekend in any case. These films have long tail releases as in the parlance, they live for many, many years. And so that doesn't mean you should stop doing press and interviews and discussions about the film, you know, after a week. I mean, I stood in front of the Lemley Monica wearing a sandwich board for 7 days. And, not a lot of filmmakers would do that, but I'm back now.
My friend Onur Tükel does it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know.
I'm sure.
I taught him how to put a sandwich board together.
Oh, that explains it, because he went and did that with, pretty sure with... the most recent,
the misogynist.
Well, it might have been the cat fight. I don't know if he's done it with misogynists. Yeah, I'm not sure. He might have, but I'll tell you, I've been to a few of his screenings, or at least at the festivals that he screened. Most recently, we were just at the Lighthouse Film Festival, and he was showing it there. And I'm telling you one thing, people. It's probably in some ways his most controversial film, but. In a way, people are really responding positively to that one too, and the Q&As are really actually very positive experiences, you know. And people of all ages are wanting to talk to him afterwards and connect with him. So anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I saw an early cut of it last year, and he and I were sort of applying to festivals together, and both recommending each other's films to other festivals.
Yeah,
I helped get it into the Hamptons.
Oh. Yeah, that's where I saw it.
But I'm still bitter about that. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah, no, I saw it at the Hamptons. That's where I saw it last year.
But I think both of us kind of came out, right when the Me Too movement was starting, which was a very interesting time and timely time to have films with, these kind of, asshole men characters.
Especially one who's dating the daughter of another asshole character. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But you said it. They're kind of assholes. They're at heart, of course, not. But they're their defensiveness and the way they interact is often putting that asshole out first.
Even the original script, right? That's the tricky balance in Bernard and Huey that I think we, for the most part, pulled off. Is that you have these, characters who they keep getting their comeuppance from the women in their worlds, mm-hmm. and so our women characters are actually very very smart and strong mm-hmm. characters, and I think that's what was attractive to Nancy Travis and Sasha Alexander and Bellamy Young and Mae Whitman is they're very complicated but strong characters. So
there's going to be a percentage of the population, the female population, that will also be frustrated because they want women to be able to play assholes. I mean,
yes,
you know,
exactly.
It's just true.
Yeah.
So, you have to also write some women as assholes. Yeah.
But it what's also interesting is, because a lot of the festivals we played at were last fall, and that was right when the Me Too movement was starting to the stories were coming out. And so, I mean, not only were the Q&As about our own films interesting, but, I mean, we were the face of filmmaking to a lot of the rest of America, so a lot of questions, came up in discussions about sort of the culture of filmmaking going on right now, so... Yeah, it was an interesting time to be out on the road, that's for sure.
Again, let's just mention Bernard and Huey is currently available for, well, you can purchase it or rent it. It's on iTunes. Anywhere else we should mention, or should we just, is iTunes sufficient?
Well, iTunes is sufficient. I mean, it's on other VOD platforms as well. If you get your films on demand, just demand that it play for you, and it will show up. And then if you're in Anchorage, go see it or Omaha or Lincoln. I'll be in Omaha and Lincoln for those screenings. It's my hometown, but. So that'll be fun. And we're also doing on August 18th in Omaha, we're doing a retrospective screening, also 25 years since my first film, Omaha the Movie. So that'll be a fun reunion with a lot of the cast and crew for that one as well. Mm-hmm. And then if people haven't gotten enough of me, they can buy my book, The Cheerful Subversive's Guide to Independent Filmmaking, available from, the easiest way is Amazon, but it's through Focal Press and Rutledge Press. And so that's, there's a lot of great stories about a lot of what we just covered,
I look forward to reading it.
You would definitely get a kick out of it. And it really is kind of a good kind of how to on how to make these kind of independent films and how to get an amazing script and how to get an amazing cast. Once you get that script, I would say there's no real secrets to it, but there are secrets, but I spill them in the book. So.
Transparency. So yeah, as long as I don't have to read another Lloyd Kaufman book, I'm happy. No. I'll be very grateful.
We love Lloyd, but this is not exactly the Troma version of how to do it, but it's a good accompaniment to his.
Great, excellent.
All right. Well, thanks.
Right when you're thanking me, that's when you cut out again. Start again. It's going to be tricky.
Oh, I said. Yeah. Yeah, good luck editing this.
Should be too bad.
Thanks again. Thanks again for having me on, Adam. And yes, I hope everyone goes out and checks out Bernard and Huey one way or the other. And for those filmmakers out there, submit to Slam Dance.
Yeah, for me, I think it's time. I once had somebody out at Slam Dance early on when I was doing this podcast, and she volunteered to do some segments from Slam Dance, which she did do, but I have not been there, and I'm,
Oh, my gosh. Well, you need to, is the year to come, 25 years.
Yeah,
exactly. If you don't come now, you'll have to wait another 25 or something. I don't know. this is definitely the year to come, and I think we're going to have some good alumni visiting. I mean, we had the Russo brothers last year, which was a lot of fun because they were literally reviewing Daly's footage from Infinity Wars while they were driving back and forth to the festival, which was exciting. And
this is the
Avengers movie.
Oh, the Avengers movie. Okay, I got you.
Yes. So they were. So it's kind of funny because they were.
War. I got it. I saw that with my son. So I'm sorry. I must have blocked it for a moment. I apologize. Apologize.
No, that's all right.
I'm going to take him to see Eighth Grade next week.
Oh, cool.
He just graduated Eighth Grade, that's why.
Yeah, I was just reading a review of it today. I don't know if it's appropriate for that age or not.
Yeah, it's rated R.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, maybe they should see it on their own, and maybe parents shouldn't see it. I don't know. I've got a kid about to enter middle school and one in high school and one in college.
You do?
Yeah, that's a lot of them, I know.
You have three?
Yeah, at last check, yeah.
Wait, what?
But, I learned this trick from Robert. I learned this trick from Robert Altman. Have a lot of kids and then make them all work on your movie because they will leave.
Perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Great idea.
So they're all credited in the movie one way or another.
Okay, I see. Oh, wait, so you have one kid in college?
Yeah, she just started at Berkeley this past year, so just getting into a sophomore year.
Congratulations. I mean, I'm sorry, both of those things at the same time. Dan, let's make sure we don't wait. Well, I don't think we were waiting, but let's do this again is my point, as soon as possible. And if you...
Yeah,
If our paths should cross in person, we could just do something other than FaceTime. I'm just saying,
Yes.
Might be a little easier.
See you in person.
But I will.
Right.
I will make lemonade out of this. I promise.
Terrific. I'm looking forward to hearing it. All right. Okay. Thanks, Adam.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
First day the snow fell. warm inside. Don't tell honey your secret is safe. Midnight unfolds in your eyes, lost in the quiet, stars come alive. Even the darkness can't hide love's imperfections. What can I do? Nobody's lying, but nobody's telling the truth. Babe, I don't wanna be right. It's making me lonely.
Thank you for tuning in and listening. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you for writing us a review on iTunes and on Stitcher. We're on YouTube. I put together a couple of playlists on our YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube and search Film Wax Radio and subscribe to our YouTube channel. There's one called The Comedians, which is a bunch of, funny people that have appeared on the show over the years, including, I don't know, Gilbert Gottfried and Pauly Shore and Brian Posehn. You know, it still kills me that I had a conversation with Kevin Pollak and Nick Kroll, two great comedians that I love, and both files got corrupt. It was one of the worst days in my podcasting history, I have to tell you. I had these I did three interviews this one day. It was during the Tribeca Film Festival, so that wasn't so unusual. And I got Nick Kroll in the morning, and that went stupendously, just went so well. And then I forget who the middle person was, but it was an obscure, you know, art film in the middle of the day. And then at the end of the day, I talked to Kevin Pollak, who directed a film about, you know, all these comedians, talking to comedians. And when I got home to transfer the files, both the Nick Kroll and the Kevin Pollak were corrupted. And the only one that was available was the interview with the art house film. But I still feel so bad. I still feel bad. I would hope that to get Nick and Kevin on the show, regardless. But I'll tell you in the future. But there is some good news. We're approaching the 500th episode. So we have on that episode, of course, Ramin Barani. I'm very excited about that. We also are looking at, what else is coming up? We also have, I just sat down with a longtime Film Wax friend, Larry Fessenden, who will be returning for his sixth visit on the podcast. I just need to start booking some friends again, because not to say I don't love having on Paul Schrader or Gus Van Sant, for God's sake, but I also wanted to, in going through tough times here, you know, the world is just in a bad place right now. I feel like everything's off kilter, you know, and I'm sort of yearning to talk to people that I care about and who care about me, and we talk and take care of each other in this way, you know. And so I'm going to be trying to book some of my regular guests on the show in the coming weeks as well. I think it's an important thing to do. Yeah. So I believe on the next episode of the podcast, which is episode 499, we're going to have on, I'm going to release this episode, a couple more segments from my visit down to Baltimore, where I went to the Maryland Film Festival a couple of months ago, and I never got around to posting some of these segments that are so wonderful. So I'm going to be putting up some of that, and we're going to have, again, the 500th episode with Ramin Barani after that. And then we'll have Larry Fessenden, who's got some great stuff coming up in August that we want to talk about and in the fall. And so it should be, you're going to love that conversation. I just edited it and it's fantastic. Also coming up is Gina Duncan, who is runs the pretty much the cinema at BAM here in Brooklyn. She is going to be on the show. And we're still waiting to post my episode with the Gold brothers, Ethan Gold and Ari Gold, and the team behind the film We the Animals, an upcoming film. We're going to be talking to those folks. The team behind the film Relaxer, which I saw back at South by Southwest last spring, they're coming up. Giancarlo Esposito is coming up in the next month or two. Many more. Lots more stuff. So keep tuning in. Please subscribe. Please tell everybody you know about the show.
contact us through the website. You can email us there. You can also reach us through Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube. We're just available. Thanks, everybody, for listening to this episode 498. My name is Adam Shartoff. The name of the show is Film Wax Radio. We'll be back in a few days with a brand new episode. Until then, please take care of yourself and the ones you love.